Yeah. They have increased the number of layers. There's a lot of software available. I think in the old days, if you wanted something that complicated, you basically had to do industrial runs of some kind. Nowadays, there are companies that give you the software, and you can design your circuits with multiple layers. Hopefully you know enough to how to deal with RF and ground planes and such, because that's very important. You know, placement as the frequencies go up become problematic. But you can design incredible PC boards and just send them out, usually, unfortunately, to China, and get them back relatively quickly if you pay the shipping. It's sort of amazing what you can do these days. I know there are guys out there who make their own PC boards, but you can't really make a multi-layer PC board by yourself, as far as I'm aware. But you can have manufactured all kinds of complicated stuff at a relatively low price, I would think.
KG2R1.
Yes, David. Yes, David, did you want to say something?
Yes, sir. I have a question.
Okay. I see you're on EchoLink now.
Yes, sir, I'm relaxing now. Here's a question. If 5G signal coming directly from tower, it is many times faster than 4G, but the signal has a great deal of trouble to penetrate the window into the cafe or through the wall, and do you know the solution for this problem?
Yes, unfortunately, it's building more cell towers. The problem with 5G, and the reason why 5G has much greater bandwidth, I think the maximum bandwidth for a 4G connection is 20 megabits per second, whereas 5G, the ratings go from anywhere from 10 gigabits per second to 20 gigabits per second. And the reason you have that much more bandwidth, that much more symbol rate, is because you have a wider swath of frequency. These are going up into the tens and twenties of gigahertz. The problem with those microwave frequencies is that they have a significant free path loss and absorption, and so they don't go as far as previous 4G and 3G frequencies. So the only way that you could make up for the fact that you're now utilizing higher frequencies with far greater attenuation losses are to decrease the distance between you and the closest cell tower.
There's a better solution to the problem. And one company is making, business with these providers in order for the 5G signal to be more widespread without having to build more towers. Verizon spent $300 billion on towers when the solution is much more simple.
Well, I don't know exactly what you're going to tell me. I would assume it's going to be some variation on hotspots. When 4G came on board, they had similar problems because the higher bandwidth of 20 megabits per second required them to go at higher frequencies from the previous generation. So because they had not had time to build up the cell towers, they were selling hotspots and renting hotspots and doing all kinds of things with hotspot technology to kind of act as a repeater for the cell towers. I think they had a lot of problems in maintaining them, and they gave up and just invested in the cell towers at that time. And when I'm talking about hotspots, I don't want people to be confused by PiStar, because PiStar is a digital voice network backbone hotspot. It's not an internet, it's not a cell tower hotspot.
Well, one or two American service providers had invested in the solution to the problem, while others were building towers and spending money. So my question is, you know, what is the solution? I already know what it is.
Well, because I'm not involved in that technology, I don't know which is the most cost-effective. I would tend to assume that that telecommunications companies tend to not invest in third parties. They might buy them and then take them over, but just to hand a third party money to solve their problem. My guess ultimately is you're going to see a lot more cell towers personally, but tell me what the solution is.
You know, the solution to the problem, they call it the key. You have to have the key, you know, to operate. And how to say, you know, maybe Paul would have the answer to this question, WS2N.
Now, I don't know why I would have an answer to this question, but you're going to start telling me you're going to start in with SpaceX and their broadband Starlink system, beaming things straight down.
Leo's
K2FIU.
Yes, George recognized, and the person who said Leo, which is not the name of a nice guy, but low entry orbit? What do you want to say, George?
Low Earth orbit satellite.
Thank you, Ed. I forgot what the acronym meant. George, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, well, Bell Telephone had placed over the 20th century telephone poles. Those telephone poles were placed on grounds of real estate that is called real estate in gross. They own that little circular property that they placed it on. Whether you own the property or not, they own that. That real estate in gross to provide you with those services that were delivered over the last 100 years are still theirs. Those are their poles. Those are their pieces of property that are planted in the ground. And they could turn around and put 5G and saturate our neighborhoods where they were placing chip and ring battery and ground signals to our houses over cables. They have that right to do it. It has not been taken away by the FCC. That's why the major telephone companies, the original Bell companies and AT&T, are pushing 5G. They still own that miniature piece of real estate.
Okay, George, so that sort of agrees with my understanding that they're just going to build up the number of cell towers. It's not going to happen overnight because it's not cost effective to just, you know, throw a lot of money at one fell swoop. They have most likely a plan of high population centers that will go first, and it'll expand. But once again, I guess I turn to David, who has the solution. One gentleman suggested low Earth orbit satellites. I certainly hope Elon Musk's name doesn't come up in this explanation, but let me know what your solution is, David.
Well, there are providers with many towers, but not an excessive number of towers, but they buy into the key. The key is satellites interacting with the towers. That's it.
Okay, I'm sure there's a great deal of technological problems with getting everything handshaking and dealing with the wide swath of frequencies that are the defined 5G protocols that I doubt the most satellites are designed to handle. But, okay.
How does this get around the signal loss going through wall boards and windows?
Okay, David, Ed asked you a question. I kind of get the idea that vaguely it's just they have their own set of cell towers and satellites, and somehow they're going to augment the already available ones. But I would think the required amount of engineering to get them to talk to 5G systems is going to be incredibly expensive, and I doubt that that's going to be done personally, but it'll be interesting to see.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I think I doubled before. Anyway, the Starlink is not designed for cell towers, you know, cell phones at all. It's designed for, you know, TV, you know, high-def TV, and internet. And the same with OneWeb. That's the other big competitor that's going up against SpaceX. Again, that's really not designed for it. Nowadays, you know, yeah, you do have cell phone towers, but your cell phone satellites, you know, they you look at the phone, it still has an antenna on it, and it's going through existing satellites that have been up there for years. Was it Intel? Iridium system that's still up there. There's 66 satellites involved with that. But, you know, it's not, you know, you can't pull out your cell phone, your smartphone, and operate that. You need this. I mean, it looks like a big HC with an antenna sticking out of it. That's what they have for now. Back to you.
AC2GS. Yeah, the technologies are all different, and I don't know of any telecommunications device that has the broad frequency range that 5G has. So if you and the satellites certainly couldn't make a signal to your cell phone in your house. I mean, those satellites require roof antennas and non-obstructed areas and pointed in the right direction. So the only thing I could see using would be the cell towers that communicate with the satellites. And again, they're too few and they're not set up for the right frequencies. So I don't really see this as a viable solution. I mean, I'm not an engineer. I don't even play one on the radio. I think it's easier to, it's expensive, but it's easier to just build out the number of cell towers, not to jury-rig radio devices designed for other specifications.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
I agree with everything you said, except for one point that doesn't really change your argument. It's just a little footnote. GPS does go from satellites and through, you know, into houses and the like, although there are limitations, not so much in steel frame buildings as in private wood houses. But it is over a relatively narrow frequency band.
5G, where it cannot
go through all the things we're worried about with 5G. So it's just a footnote. It doesn't change the argument.
And objects, then if 5G service is kind of lax, then what are we really using? We're talking with 4G.
Okay, unfortunately, David, you doubled with Ed. Ed was talking about how GPS can get inside your house. As technologies have improved, there was a time where they really couldn't get into your house. The signal strength was just in the number of satellites and the technology of the receiver chips. But over the years, yeah, they've been able to get through. But they have a very low symbol rate, as you mentioned. And the whole idea of 5G is to push 10 gigabits per second through that pipeline. And you know, you're just not going to do that with GPS. But getting back to David's comment when he was doubling with Ed, what are we using? We're using 4G for the most part. People are trying to build up and shift over to 5G. And I've talked to him before that I think that the telecommunications industry has really big plans for becoming the ISP provider. You know, you're going to throw out your Fios router and your Optimum TV router, and you'll just have a cell phone as a hotspot for your house, and you'll get streaming services from the telephone company. You'll get music services. You'll get their version of Netflix. You'll get their version of Facebook, their version of the metaverse, and there'll be one big telecommunications world. So I think they have some degree of delusions of grandeur, and that's what is driving them, I think, to invest a great deal of money in this 5G technology. And no doubt, as soon as we get used to it, we'll have to deal with 6G.
I tell you, Roy, I'm going to keep this phone till at least 2023, if not 2024. I'm waiting for 5G to be seamless.
Okay, that is certainly your right and privilege. I know people who have been holding on to their 3G phones, and in the last few months, after their telecommunications company has repeatedly advised them to go out and buy a new phone, they simply sent them a new phone because they're going to turn 3G off. So there will come a time, I can't tell you when, but there will inevitably come a time when the people responsible for the cell towers will turn off the 4G in favor of pure 5G, and probably by then 6G, and then you'll have a choice of using your cell phone as a very nice paperweight or getting a new phone. But again, you're free to make the decision. The problem is that the big companies ultimately make the decision of what devices will work on their equipment.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
5G is intended to replace Fios, to replace coaxial lines from poles, to replace coaxial and fiber optic lines that are mid-station into neighborhoods. But 4G as a backbone is a different signal service 4G LTE is a long-term, LTE long-term expansion of actual router stations at central points to bring it to the distribution points. So when you're going to go to 5G, let me let this go and come back with something else. KD2FIU. Fios was 30 years too late in technology. And it was rolled out to be an answer to all communication speeds and technology to be delivered to your home. And they realized that too late. They being Verizon. And they realized that when other companies were dealing with totally overriding physical interconnected lines to your home, to where you are when you're with a high-speed smartphone or high-speed device in your mobile. So what happened was is that they expanded the actual development of 5G to say that this is how we're going to get to you. This is not how we're building our network backbone. LTE is still going to be our network backbone. KD2FIU.
Okay, but they could still implement some aspect of LTE into 5 and future 6G, and I think it's kind of inevitable that there'll be some aspects of 4G that they would rather not have to deal with, and so they would just push people to go into 5G and by then 6G. And I agree with you. They want a wireless high bandwidth connection all over the place. They don't want a fiber optic costs, they think, costs too much money, and RF is the way to go. But again, I still think inevitably there will be a sundowning of 4G capable cell phones eventually. Again, I won't say if it's 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, but I do not think it's going to be a legacy thing where, you know, 50 years from now, if you have a 4G cell phone, it's going to work anyplace.
Oh, absolutely. 3G is the one that's going to have the sun down right now. The sun is setting on 3G over the next couple of years. 4G is the backbone, with long-term expansion. And by the way, the FCC wants the phone companies, the telecommunications companies, whatever you're going to call them in our day in 2022, the FCC wants this done because they want infrastructure that is less vulnerable to be destroyed.
Okay, I don't know if RF is indestructible. I guess it really depends upon whether you put about an EMF bomb and fry circuits, whether everything is shielded against high RF pulses. We'll see. If 4G kind of gets retired, I'm sure it's not going to get retired for another 10 years, but I think ultimately everything does get retired, including us. So I think there's nothing strange and different about 4G. But I thank you, George, and I thank you, David. It's already 10:25. I'm already eating out of a four-pole SpaceNet report, so I want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and I hope you enjoyed the little teeny puzzles. I hope I'll find some more for you in the future. This is AC2GS, and let's hear Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N. And Yeah, okay, well, daylight savings time, so no problem, I'll just talk faster. That'll make up for the time lost, Roy. No problem. Good topic. And 3G, I had a backup telephone. You never know. It was so inexpensive. It was a 3G flip phone, and sure enough, that's canceled. So like you said, they either send you one or you just go out and get another one. That's 4G, and you're good to go. Okay, there was a couple of topics I just wanted to go through here. Ingenuity is the helicopter that's still on Mars and still functioning after now 21 flights. It was designed for 5 flights on Mars, and we're already up to 21. It's flown over, collectively over 3 miles. Flies on a regular basis, 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes, and then it'll come back down and land. It leads the way for the Perseverance rover. It looks at different, the ground, everything that's in front of it. Even so, Perseverance has navigation cameras and all. This gives it more of a heads up. They've been using it. And it has 2 cameras on board. One is a navigation camera. Another one looks out to the horizon. Taking pictures of the rover on Mars, it's very successful, and it's still as good as new. That was the last report I just read on a couple of websites. Still very good. The blades, the 2 big blades that spin there, 1 counterclockwise, 1 clockwise, 4-foot long blades. All the gearing mechanisms, everything that's connected to this, the servos are all working perfectly, they said. So it's working like new. So highly successful. There's not another planned helicopter mission for Mars, but if they ever go back there, that will definitely be included, and they have bigger ones planned. Of course, they need the funding, and they need the okay. Right now, they're more concerned with the mission that will fly to Mars to return all the samples that Perseverance is collecting. And I think Perseverance has already collected 5 of them, and by the time it's done, it will have collected over 30 of these things to be returned to Earth. But in the meantime, this helicopter keeps on flying. It's amazing. They were hoping, like I said, for 5 flights, now they're up to 21. Okay, there's another mission that's getting underway. Eventually will be launched this August, and it's planned on launching from a SpaceX heavy rocket, and it's called the Psyche mission. Psyche will go to an asteroid with the same name, Psyche, out in the asteroid belt. It's a very solid metal asteroid. They figured that out, about 140 miles in diameter, and they plan on orbiting this thing with Psyche. But the reason I'm bringing it up is they now have the solar panels attached to it. They've got the big bus, or the big main frame wall built that's around 10 feet high. But now they've attached these massive solar panels. And there's 2 of them, and they're about 74 feet long collectively. But it also opens up in an X fashion, so you're winding up with the same amount of square feet as they say a tennis court. So to go out there, years ago they would have said, well, you need a radioisotope thermoelectric generator to produce enough power to keep the batteries charged to do a job like this. But they've gotten very good with solar panels. The efficiency of them has gone way up over the last couple of decades. They're going to drive this thing all the way to the asteroid belt with solar panels. And we'll do a couple of gravity assists. One is going to pass Earth, and another one is going to pass Mars to accelerate the spacecraft to go all the way out to Jupiter. Before Jupiter, the asteroid belt in between Mars and Jupiter. If you had this thing, let's say, in orbit of Earth, instead of just going all the way out to the asteroid belt, with the amount of solar panels they have on here, they'd be producing just over 21 kilowatts of power. So it would be enough to drive, let's say, 5 homes. If, you know, if each home took, say, 4 kilowatts of power, that's the general number that they always use. So it would be a lot of power in orbit, but by the time it gets all the way out to the asteroid belt, it'll only be getting 2 kilowatts of power due to the inverse square law. You know, you double the distance, you square it. So by the time you get out there, you're way down to around 2 kilowatts of power. But it's enough to keep the batteries charged and do what it needs to do. It's also enough to run the ion engine. Ion engines really need a lot of electrical power, and this will do it. It's going to help it get out there quicker. So looking forward to that launch. Like I said, it's going to be on a SpaceX heavy rocket. That's one of these ones, you know, you take like a Falcon 9 rocket, and you take 2 more Falcon 9 rockets and attach it to the core. And it's like launching 3 at one time. They've done that before. In fact, they've done it a few times. And that's where the boosters usually separate and come back, and they land back at Cape Canaveral. And the center core, they tried to land in the ocean, out in the ocean on a barge ship. That last time they did that barge failed, but you know, they did get 2 of the boosters back. Last couple of times they tried this Falcon Heavy. So we'll see how it goes. It's a very heavy satellite to go all the way to Mars. It weighs some 6,000 pounds. Usually you load it up with fuel and you can double that, so it's probably like an 11,000 pound satellite going all the way up past Mars. But looking forward to the August launch. See how things go. They're assembling all the equipment and thrusters and science equipment. I think probably at least 5 or 6 science instruments are going to be on board. They've got these big massive antennas, like they look like big dipole antennas that are going to come out of this thing. Trying to get the numbers on how long they are, but they look pretty big. I mean, just by looking at them, they look like 40 meter dipoles to me. But apparently they're going to use this for checking the magnetic fields of this particular asteroid. So the scientists really want to get a look at this. For some reason, this thing is probably the core of a planet that never developed. That's what they're thinking. So they really want to evaluate this. We'll see how it goes. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. Another successful activity on Mars is by the Perseverance rover. It has two microphones on board. One is on the body of the rover itself. It's on the left-hand side of it. And then the other one is up near the camera. The mass cam has a microphone attached to it. And what they did is they always wanted to check the speed of sound on Mars. So this Madcam has one of the things it has on board on top is the same thing that Curiosity had. It'll shoot a laser out and hit a rock multiple times, you know, over and over again in milliseconds. And as the laser hits the rock or whatever they're aiming at, it vaporizes the material. It goes up to, I don't know, some huge temperature, but it's done in, you know, milliseconds. And it vaporizes, and as it's doing that, each time it clicks, there's also a camera coming from the same place where the laser is. And that camera is taking a picture every time this thing flies and it's hitting the target. And that camera has a spectrometer on it, so it's able to figure out what that particular rock is made of. This thing might be 20 or 30 feet away, and you don't need a fancy chemical lab to figure out what it is. You just read the gas that's coming off from the spectrometer, and you know that's the main purpose of it. But it also makes a noise. It makes a zapping noise. They've actually recorded the sounds of that. They didn't have any cameras on Curiosity, but Perseverance, this one does. And it's been riding around up there since February 18th of last year, so it's now just over a year riding around on Mars. The test, they've done this test a couple of times already. They'll fire the laser as it hits the rock, which might be 20, 30 feet away, maybe even down on the ground. They do the math real quick of exactly how far it is from that rock to the camera. And that's exactly where the microphone is, so they could actually hear the zapping noise, and they time it, time how long that takes. And they figured out on Mars, when they did the test, it was coming out around 240 meters per second. Compared to Earth, which is like 340 meters per second. You do the math, you convert it to miles per hour, and miles per hour, on Earth, you wind up with your standard number is 759 miles per hour. So roughly 760 miles per hour is the speed of sound on Earth. With this, with this pressure and the average humidity, that's the number that's always given. When they did the test on Mars, it comes out a lot slower. Mars has a carbon dioxide atmosphere. And because of that, and because of the density of it, it's very, very rarefied. Pressure is so low, it would be like if you were 100,000 feet in the air on Earth, that's how low the pressure would be. Here it's like one bar, well, there it's like 1/100th of a bar of pressure. But there is sound, so if you're out there, you would be able to hear it if you had it. You'd have a spacesuit on, but you'd have a microphone on the outside of your spacesuit, you'd be able to hear the zapping noise. But the sound is slower. It comes back at 240 meters per second, which translates to 536 miles per hour. So I thought that was pretty interesting. It also has two microphones on Perseverance, so they could check with two microphones if they had to. But a good experiment, and it's still doing great work. It's only up there a little over a year now, and I wouldn't be surprised if this thing you know, keeps going like the Curiosity rover that's still going. That thing landed in 2012, and here we are in 2022. That thing's racked up a lot of years, a lot of miles, still going. And I know it's on Dr. Roy's website. Well, he, you know, thanks a lot, by the way, Roy. He put a picture up of the I sent him the helicopter Ingenuity sitting on Mars. But I know I probably put that picture up a couple of years ago when it was getting ready to go, but I thought I'd put it up again. But also, he's got an article about a rock. You know, Roy came up with this. There's a rock stuck in a wheel on this rover on Perseverance. So, you know, the wheels are like big drums, you know, and then they get spokes coming out of it. And they're very wide, and probably about 20 inches wide. And apparently, somewhere along the line, or, you know, as it was rolling, a rock must have, like, rolled down a little incline or something, and wound up rolling inside of this drum. So as it rides, as it goes along, this rock is, you know, tumbling along, and I don't know, maybe it'll make a sharp turn one day, and it'll fall out. But as this thing rides, you know, mile after mile, this rock is clanking around, you know. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I did see a picture of that on probably on the NASA website a while back. Any comments, questions? WS2N. Okay, talking about rovers. There was a company that's making some good headway in developing a rover. Venturi Astrolab is the name of it. But this rover is not for Mars. It's for the moon, and it's eventually for people. I mean, we do have there is a Viper rover, a small, you know, unmanned rover that will be going up there shortly. But this company is developing one for astronauts to actually ride around on. In a couple of years, first mission that would require a rover that astronauts would ride on would be Artemis 3. We didn't get to Artemis 1 yet. Artemis 1 is going to go around the moon, unmanned, come back, splash down in the Pacific. Artemis 2 will go around the moon. This time it will be manned, and they just won't land on the moon. We'll send four astronauts for a ride around the moon, check everything out. They'll come back and land in the Pacific Ocean, get picked up. Artemis 3, that will be the one where they'll go around the moon and meet up with a human landing vehicle, and most likely human landing system that was chosen right now, and the only one that was chosen, is by SpaceX. So it will meet up with a Starship vehicle that has not even gone into orbit yet, but yet that's the plan, and go down to the moon and land. At that time, they feel that they would need a rover there. And this company says they could send one ahead of the landing. They figure that the landing is going to be so exact that they won't have any kind of a problem. You could actually have a rover there, or you could bring the rover with you on the SpaceX vehicle. And the name of this thing is just called Flex, F-L-E-X. And be able to carry maybe 4,000 pounds worth of stuff, I guess 4,000 pounds of Earth stuff. On the moon it would weigh 1/6 of that, but you'd also be able to carry two astronauts. It looked like what I saw is they'll be in a standing position, not in a sitting position, like the rovers, the three rovers that were left on the moon by 16, 15, and 14, or 17 was last mission. 17, 16, and 15. Well, they had their own rovers, and they had these seats. The seats looked like, you know, beach chairs, and in fact, they looked exactly like that. And they would ride around on the moon with this four-wheel vehicle. But this one, they would stand on the back of it and hang on to it and strap themselves, you know, attach themselves to it. And that's how you plan on maneuvering around it on flex. And they're designing it to also be autonomous. You know, you could be sitting in the spacecraft and you could actually send the thing off on a drive if you needed to. And they could set up solar panels maybe by itself. We'll see how that works out in the distant future. But there's other companies involved with trying to do this as well. Northrop Grumman, they have a plan for a rover. Also GM. But these people, they've actually built one. Chris Hadfield is a Canadian astronaut, been up to the space station a number of times. He test drove it not too long ago. I think he was down in Death Valley. And him and another astronaut also tested it out. Gave great reports. And who knows, maybe that will be the one they charge. GM is trying to develop one as well. General Motors is the one that is responsible for building the original three rovers that are now sitting on the moon. They were instrumental in building that. So maybe GM will come up with their own design. Like I said, Flex by Venturi Astrolab is the only one that actually has a working model that people can go out and look at, actually drive on. Any questions? WS2N. Okay, talking about Artemis, the Artemis 1 mission that's going to go to the moon and around the moon and orbit it a number of times and then eventually come back. That's actually getting ready to go. I wouldn't be surprised if that thing launched in May or June. I mean, there's actually predictions for it to launch in April, but, we'll see how the tests go. Right now, they're going to roll it out. They call it a rollout when they bring it from the vehicle assembly building in Florida. It'll go on that crawler, you know, the same crawler that they use for the space shuttles. They used to bring the space shuttles out on a crawler, go to either Launch Complex 39A or Launch Complex 39B, and that's where the space shuttles used to launch from. As well as the Saturn V, the original Saturn V. Those crawlers were built for the Saturn V rocket. They bring out the whole Saturn V, completely assembled, along with the launch tower. And that would ride all the way out, miles to the... like 3 miles to Launch Complex 39B. That's where this is going to go from. 39A is being occupied now by SpaceX, but they designed 39B to specifically launch this Artemis rocket, Artemis space launch system from that complex. This thing stands, you know, almost 400 feet tall, so it's like being on at the top. It'd be like on a top of a 40-story building. Which is always, you know, you guys that have, worked in offices or, in my case, in construction, you stand on the end of a 40-story building looking down with no walls, and, you get an idea of how high you are. And that's how high this rocket is, 40 stories tall, 400-foot rocket will be brought out starting St. Patrick's Day, just a couple of days,
on the 17th, they plan on starting to roll it out from the vehicle assembly building. I hope they do it. They've run countless amounts of tests, and they, you know, check this out, check that out. Yeah, this was supposed to be done, I don't know, a couple of months ago. But as they were checking things out, they found a problem with the number 4 engine. They have a computer, you know, each engine has a computer on a computer controller, they call it, and which is pretty big. It's a big unit. It's attached to the side of each engine, you know, maybe about, you know, 18 inches by 18 inches. This thing is attached. It's got all kinds of tubings and pipes and everything, you know, sensors and things that come off this computer that go to different various places. But that had to be changed out. They found one little chip in there that wasn't, you know, sometimes it was working and sometimes it wasn't. It was intermittent, which I thought was kind of strange, but, you know, they tested them before. They've actually lit off all 4 engines at one time in Mississippi, Stennis, Mississippi, where they test these things. Where everything worked great. But then when they were, brought everything to Florida, and they were testing everything, they found this one little chip problem. They didn't know what it was. They completely removed it. You know, the whole unit. Replaced it with another one, and then after, before they got the okay, they wanted to make sure what the problem was. They found a defective chip. So, what are you going to do? It cost them a couple of months, but St. Patrick's Day they'll be rolling out to the pad, and then they'll fuel it. They'll actually, duplicate going through a launch, completely fuel it. The systems, don't fly on liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen fuel, liquid oxygen. The two solid boosters will be attached to it. They have 5 segmented pieces for each booster. Same kind of design what they had on the shuttle. You know, you had the two boosters. Here you got, each booster is going to have 4 segments on the shuttle. This one's same segment, but you're going to have 5. So basically, you're going to have more fuel, and you'll be able to lift more tonnage to orbit, or in this case, to the moon. So looking forward to the rollout. Not as exciting as the launch, but. It's really a step in the right direction. And I guess if that all goes okay, they'll probably start, getting ready for some kind of actual launch date. But if all goes well, they won't, it won't be shifted. We'll see. We'll see how this goes. This over $10 billion project they've been working on since actually the close of the space shuttle, which was August 2011. So, any comments? WS2N for the SpaceNet report. Okay. Scientists, always looking to find something new, and they found something new to do, but from something old. Last mission I mentioned before was Apollo 17 to the moon. That was Eugene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt. They walked on the moon, and with them they brought back rocks like the previous missions. Collectively, all the missions, the 6 missions that returned, had around 850 pounds of moon rock was brought back, and some of them wound up as gifts going to different countries, but most of them were being evaluated by the scientists.
I remember back then, you know, any of us that are old enough that were watching these moon launches years ago. When they brought the rocks back, I remember them saying they were going to keep some of the rocks and they were going to store them. They were not, you know, they were going to be vacuum packed, you know, that's it. They're totally sealed off from the rest of the world, like a time capsule. And they said, we're going to wait like 50 years. And, you know, back in 1972, when they locked these things up for the next 50 years, they said, you know, we have capabilities of figuring this out and figuring that out, you know, on a rocket. These geologists had all kinds of equipment. But they said, we can't even imagine what we'll have in 50 years from now. So let's save these things. And we'll open them up 50 years from now. I would imagine, I mean, I thought by then we were going to have continual flights eventually to the moon. We wouldn't need to do something like this, you know. As the years went by, you know, 50 years from now, bring back another rock and look at it, and we'll see what it's all about. But they kept certain rocks in different locations on the moon. And sure enough, I think last week or the week before, they started opening up canisters and some of these that was stored. And sure enough, the scientists are investigating it. Probably putting it through, you know, high-tech equipment that I have no idea what they're probably using. But I know whatever it is, it's better than what they had 50 years ago. So I thought I'd bring that up. I thought that was pretty interesting to go through time. I remember them saying they were going to put these things away for safekeeping until the future. I don't know if anybody else remembers them doing that. WS to us. Okay, I really don't have all that much. I know Starliner is getting ready to fly again. Starliner is built by Boeing. Launched by Boeing and Lockheed on the Atlas V rocket. But that's, you know, coming along. They say that should be ready. They thought, well, maybe a September launch. Now, this Starliner, you know, the goal is to have eventually a crew of four, just like you have on the Dragon with SpaceX. You know, Boeing wanted to be able to put a crew of four on here and travel to the International Space Station. And the idea from NASA was, you know, when they gave these billion-dollar contracts out, they gave it to SpaceX, and they also gave it to Boeing to develop these manned spacecraft to go to the International Space Station. And they believe in redundancy, you know. They'll both probably work, you know, and everything will be fine. Well, it's been a couple of years now, and SpaceX has been the only one flying people to the space
that
station.
Time because complete.
Starliner, it didn't work. They tested it. They launched it on an Atlas V like they're supposed to. And this is December of 2019, so a couple of years ago already. And it was supposed to dock with the space station. Never made it that far. It got up into orbit. And they realized it was having problems. It had software problems. It had other computer problems with, you know, unable to get away from the service module in time. It almost hit the service module when it was going to deorbit. They realized it didn't have enough fuel because of the software problem. It thought it was located in a different part of space, and it kept firing its engines to try to get to the International Space Station. So they started running low on fuel, and they deorbited it, and eventually landed in proper location in New Mexico. So a lot of things did work. The airbags worked great. You know, it lands on land. The crew, when the crew comes back from the space station, they'll be landing on land, not
the water, like